Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Nathan Belt. Nathan is a country artist based here out of Nashville.
If you are listening to this episode on Spotify or any other platform, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusik Podcast. Over there, you can see live performances with all of our guests. You can also watch the podcast you're listening to. Check it out. You can see Nathan's beautiful face while he performs some songs for us. Like, subscribe, share, all that good stuff. It helps us out a ton. Check it out.
A lot. Oh yeah,
I think that was one of the biggest surprises for us, was just how much other
pot.
How much other stuff. And I'm sure that's changed over time as well, but like, when did you get out to Nashville? How long have you been here for?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I first came to Nashville in 2001 is when I first got here.
Okay. So you beat us by a little bit.
Early 2000s, and it was still, you know, it was coming out of the 90s thing, and music was changing. Napster had, you know, started up. And boy, that changed the scene. But no, when I first got to town, I was just 21. And previously to that, I'd come up to visit and stayed here in 1999. A guy named Billy Burnett I had met performing out in Dallas. He saw me performing. He did a 5-song demo on me and started shopping it around. And some people from a company called Hamsteen Music contacted me, and they flew out to Texas to Grapevine to watch me perform. And there was an Opry out there I used to play on, and called the Grapevine Opry, and they came out to see the show there. And then they wanted to negotiate with me a contract and have me sign a deal. It was an artist development publishing contract with Hamsteen Music. Hamsteen was a company owned by a guy named Bill Ham. Okay. Bill Ham was the manager of ZZ Top and some other performers.
Really, Brian and I both love ZZ Top. Yeah. That's, we have, I don't even want to say a weakness, just a full-fledged love for
really? That band. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this guy was bigger than life. And I actually drove down to Austin and stayed in a hotel down there with a buddy, and we went to his office, and he wanted to meet me before they signed me. And he was in this big desk. It just, you know, like I said, larger than life guy with a big old cigar. And it was like you see on television. It's like, seriously, it was like in a movie or something. And he's sitting there at this big desk up in the top, and he's just,
I love that when somebody just plays the exact stereo.
It was the stereotype. It totally was.
That's hilarious.
But it was awesome. And he was so nice. He was incredibly nice and kind to me, and just wanted to know my story, who I was, and all that. And, you know, I was just, you know, a little wide-eyed kid, didn't know idea what I was getting into. But he was very kind and made me feel very comfortable. And they wanted to sign me, but ultimately the contract, my attorney at the time didn't like the contract and told my parents that this would be a bad decision to sign this. And so we passed on it. My dad still regrets that. He has regrets about it, but you know,
yeah. Kinda. Does it coming into that scene at that point? Did it feel at all to yourself like they were attempting to pigeonhole you, or did it feel as though you, or was that kind of the game plan for yourself? Did you sort of want
I've
that?
I've struggled. Actively? Talking about pigeonhole, I've struggled with that my entire career as far as music goes. I mean, I came out when I started playing. Started in the 90s scene when 90s country was big and popular, and that's what I wanted to do, man. That's what I was inspired by. I mean, I grew up listening to the classic artist because of my family, but when the 90s came around and those artists like Garth and Clint Black and Alan Jackson and Tracy Lawrence, and I was obsessed. I just became completely infatuated with all those artists, and I went through phases. I went through a Garth phase where I just wanted to be Garth for a while. I went through a George Strait phase where I just wanted to be George. I went through a Tracy Lawrence phase. I grew my hair out, grew a mullet, and my sister permed it for me. I mean, it was, you know. And But I was just a kid, you know, I was 15, 16. I was learning. I was.
And you need to, when you're a young person, to. I do truly feel. I think that, again, I think we do this in all elements of life, but you almost have to put on those costumes to find who you are. Like, there's no. I don't think there's a shortcut to it. I think the only way, whether you're a guitar player, whether you're a songwriter, singer, whatever, or, you know, whether you're a sculptor, I think you need to put on those costumes and inhabit those characters and see, okay, is this approximating what I am?
Yeah.
And then you put on the next costume. Okay, is this approximating what I am? And you end up sort of becoming the lump sum total of all of those, all of those costumes. But it's a hard thing because you can't skip that process.
It's true.
And people, I don't know, like, people give young folks grief for doing that. And I can never see it that way because I think, no, like, it's what we all do. It's the process. And you never stop doing it. You might get a little more refined at it and you might, you know, you might not be modeling your hair after whomever, but you do it nonetheless. And I always find it leaves a bad taste in my mouth when I see people, kind of put that thing down for young artists. And I think, again, for people who are interested in anything, you inevitably do it. But
yeah,
it's an odd thing. It's an odd thing because I think it's the only way you really get there.
Right. You're finding your own voice. And it's a journey that you're on. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, every artist is inspired by someone that came before them.
Exactly.
No matter who it is.
What what was it about country music at that time that caught you? Because I know for me, you know, I grew up with a lot of 90s country, and at the time I didn't like it at all. It's one of those things sort of weirdly as I have gotten older, actually just Brian and I've talked about this quite recently, really just in the last year or two, I've gone back to a lot of that stuff and really fall in love with it and think, oh, this is fucking great music. But it just wasn't, it was at the time, it just didn't resonate for me at that point in your life. Why was that music? Why did it grab you?
It's just who I was at the time. I guess it was my surroundings, the environment I was in, growing up in Texarkana and East Texas. And, you know, I just, music was always around my entire life. I was surrounded by music. From my family's playing guitar and singing as a hobby, and then their record collection. But I don't know. You know, in my mind, I think back to hearing Vince Gill on the radio when Pocket Full of Gold came out, and or Keith Whitley, Miami, Miami on the radio, and when he died, and them talking about his death. And I remember, I have all these little memories of that are music related. But when 90s country came around, Garth is really what inspired me to be a musician and do music. Because before that, I wanted to be a comic book artist. I was obsessed with art.
Really? I was the same way. I loved drawing. I mean, I still do. I love drawing. I love painting. Mm-hmm. Love sketching. But that's fantastic.
I loved art. I loved drawing. I loved Superman and Batman and the DC comics. That's what I loved. And so my parents, they would send me to art classes. I took a lot of different art classes, and especially during the summer. And I decided at a very early, I even had a character that I created and came up with and was writing stories for, and called Shadow Striker was the name of it.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
He's kind of a Batman character.
That's amazing.
But so that's what I saw the path for me, you know, where I was headed. But then Garth came along, and I was fascinated with his music. Friends in Low Places. I remember hearing The Thunder Rolls for the first time, and sitting in the backseat of the car, you know, and I thought, man, this is so out there. Thunder Rolls was kind of a shocking thing. I remember the controversy around it. People talking, the DJ even talking about it on the radio and how controversial it was. But there was something about him. But what really did it for me was the day we were moving from Texarkana to McKinney, Texas, loading the U-Haul. It was snowing outside. It was in December. And Garth Brooks' television special came on, his very first one, where he's got the blue and black with the white piping on. And I watched that show. And sitting there watching that, that's immediately I said, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. You know, it knocked me out. And I thought, that looks like so much fun. Yeah. That's what I want to do. And so I started listening to his music a lot. But eventually, I don't know what made my dad do it, but he decided to get a guitar for Christmas in 93. And that's when it really took off. Mm-hmm. But the 90s country, what did it for me? I don't know, man. The sound, I love. In fact, I was just having this conversation with somebody else. Somebody called me about producing some tracks, and they want to do a kind of a throwback to the 70s mm-hmm. and 80s kind of sound, which I love too. But myself, you know, where I'm going right now, it does have more of a strong 90s thing. It's kind of a weird thing. That's what's trendy and becoming trendy now
again.
Yeah,
it's funny. It's like coming back around. Yeah.
But for me personally, that's just what I've always known. Yeah. That's what country music sounds like to mm-hmm. me. And yeah, so it's just more of a natural thing for me.
Yeah, it's such sonically, it was such a unique time in country music. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of things contemporarily are very much paying homage to that. I mean, it's like everything, like fashion, like everything else. I'm sure it's all just cyclical, but it does seem like that production mm-hmm. and even that songwriting to a very large extent is really coming back around. And it's something that's really grown on me over, particularly the songwriting. I mean, the formula has really grown on me a lot. That 90s kind of, that 90s style of writing. There's some great stuff in there. Like as someone who does write songs, what is it about that 90s formula that you've taken into the 21st century?
Well, what's weird about this, so when I started writing as a kid, you know, like 16 years old.
What is your background in songwriting in the first place, I guess?
I just started making up songs when I was 16 or... Mm-hmm. And even before that, I wrote a song called "I'm Coming Home with My Sister." It was, you know, just a really simple song. But she's 10 years older and was in music. But I would just start with an idea and kind of just go down the page, you know, mm-hmm. with the story. And I had a song called "The Brushstroke Town" that I wrote, and I guess that was one that someone from the publishing company I was talking to was impressed with, and they kind of used that one. Mm-hmm. But when I got here talking about the formula, they started connecting me with songwriters, and established songwriters, veteran songwriters that are great, you know, great songwriters. And I began to learn a lot about how... Okay, there's a hook line. Nashville's formula, especially in the 90s and in the early 2000s coming into it, they taught me that you got to have a hook line. There's always a hook line. Usually you'll start with the chorus and then you structure the verses around it. Mm-hmm. There's going to be the first verse, maybe there's two verses, and then, you know, the chorus and then another verse, and then you add the bridge. You only add a bridge if it needs it. Mm-hmm. You know. And writing in the song, as far as if it's going to get airplay, you want your song to get to the chorus within a minute. It's got to be to that chorus. But if it's longer than a minute and you're not to that chorus yet, then it's not going to be it.
I think for myself, it's what, again, it kind of saying what I was saying earlier about coming back to that music later. One of the things that I have really, I don't want to say I have more sympathy for, but that does connect greater now than in the past mm-hmm. is that formula. Because at least for my own songwriting, you know, I write wholly in character, and my songs are, you know, they're not going to be getting any, you know, top 10 radio play anytime, just because the nature of the kind of songs I write are sort of strange and wonky and sure. different. But but one of the things that I really do enjoy about that kind of songwriting, looking back on it, is they are very effective narratively. Mm-hmm. And I think country music in general, obviously as a whole, is good at this. And this is something that, you know, kind of talking about traditional roots music, folk music, in contrast to country. I mean, they're night and day. You know what I mean? Like your traditional music is writing to the line, because those are the lines that you remember, just sort of as a point of fact. The ones that are going to be retained are the ones that stick with you, you know? Mm. Whereas country music tends to be more narrative and tends to be more, not A to B to C to D, but there is some, you can step back and see a larger story there.
Yeah.
And that's something that as I've gone back and visited country music, particularly at that time, it's something that I do find is very effective at that point in country music.
Yeah.
Is the form serves the narrative very, very well.
Yeah, it
does.
And that
happened. Yeah. I mean, again, like, you know, Hank was doing that. That's been the case for, you know, Ernest Tubbs was great at that. Like, that happens in the whole in country music.
Yeah.
But I do find the formula at that point in country music really served what country music is very, very well.
You had some really amazing songwriters too during that era.
Yeah, for sure.
That were putting out some incredible music, and mm-hmm. and of course you still had guys from the older days that were coming through. I mean, but Dean Dillon was amazing. You know, Troy Sills was still writing, had some incredible hits. But a lot of the guys that were writing with Garth were incredible mm-hmm. songwriters as well. Kent Blasey and. But, I think that structure, it was definitely more emphasis on that, mm-hmm. As far as for radio airplay during that era.
What, outside of songwriting, in terms of singers, mm-hmm. who were the singers, you know, 90s or otherwise, that have influenced you the most?
I had a very wide range of...
good.
Yeah, no, well, and that's one of the things that's contributed to... earlier when you mentioned about pigeonholing, mm-hmm. you know, people trying to pigeonhole me, because when I first got to Nashville, that's what they wanted to do, figure mm-hmm. out pigeonholing.
Yeah, and you have to find a way of selling it. Like, okay, what is it that I'm buying here?
Yeah, you as the artist, you are a product, merchandise, you know, they're trying to sell you, and they've got to find out, well, how are we going to market this guy? And the influences vocally, golly, there's been a lot. Elvis, of course, is one of the biggest vocalist influence. I come from a family of singers and people that love to sing and love good vocalists. And so I love people that are good, strong singers. Mm-hmm. So because of that kind of, I didn't really get into the folk thing and more of the songwriter stuff. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I like we talked about prior to rolling here. I teach. That's my day job. And I love Elvis. I think Elvis is the greatest performer of all time. And at some point, some class I was teaching this past year, I sat them down. I don't even remember the context of what it was, but any excuse to show them Elvis. And I showed them, you know, it's a class of like, you know, seventh graders or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I showed them Elvis doing his comeback special.
Yeah.
And even just for those 5 minutes, you know, these kids who, this is not what they're listening to.
Right.
For those 5 minutes, they all just sat there like, oh, and it's the entire, I'm trying to think which song in particular we listened to. I'm blanking on which song I showed them, but the entire song is just a still one shot of him performing live.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And the kids were like, their jaws were on the floor, and they're like, you know, like they're like 12 years old.
Yeah.
And they're like, what in the fuck is this? Like, cause he's just killing it. You're like, oh my, they're like, yeah, I'm like sitting there like trying not to cry. I'm like, oh my God. But yeah, I think he is one of the greatest, if not the greatest performer of all time. So that's a good one to model in some capacity, you know?
Well, Elvis has been a mainstay in my life. It's been a constant in my life throughout my entire life since I was a child, since I was 6 years old, because the record collection my parents had, my grandma Belt was a huge obsessed Elvis fan. Mm-hmm. And she even went to Graceland in the late 50s knocking on the door.
That's amazing.
I mean, she, yeah.
Yeah, I have one story I've actually never told on this show before, and I'm sure I'm going to botch this in some way. So my grandma, who's very, very, is very young, both my parents and my grandmother had us when they were quite young. And so back in the 70s, my grandmother was working, as she always was, and she was raising two kids. And her and, again, and I apologize, I'm sure I'm going to get some of this wrong, just the setup to this story. But one of her coworkers dragged her along to this Elvis show, and she loved Elvis, but she never went and got out of the fucking house, right? You know, she was a single mom raising two kids. It was just not going to happen. And and they go to this Elvis show. And of course, my grandmother looked like a supermodel back then. You know what I mean? Like, it was hilarious. And she's like trying to talk to like the people working the venue. Like, can we like get back there and like talk to him and like meet him or whatever? Yeah. And one of the guys said, you know, like, we can't right now, but if you come to this address or whatever afterwards, Elvis is having like a kind of like a house party where a bunch of the people in the scene are going to come and hang out. And like, you guys should come and try and come along to this.
Yeah.
And you know, my grandmother's coworkers, like, we're not. Like, of course we got to go. Of course we got to go. She, you know, practically drags my grandmother there. They're like, there's no way we're going to hang out with Elvis, right? They watch the show. Show's fucking great. They go to wherever this was. It was like a hotel or something like that, you know? Yeah. And all of these music people are there. And, oh my God, Elvis walks in the room. And to this day, it was during his sort of... he was very much getting into religion at the time and was reading the Bible constantly. So he was just going around kind of sermonizing to everyone.
Preaching to people.
Exactly. Yeah. Just preaching.
Yeah.
And she tells me to this day, at one point he walked in the room and he put his arm on her shoulder and she's like, I could have died. I could have been like, I touched Elvis. It was all over. You know what I mean? I'm like, God, that's the coolest fucking story in the world.
That's
hilarious.
That's awesome.
But yeah. So now, you know, whenever I see Elvis, I think, oh, you knew her or you knew him. You know?
Yeah.
You guys hung out once.
Oh, thank you. Awesome. Sure.
Alexa, can I grab one of those? Is that cool?
The bomb diggity.
Anyway, I'm sure I got some of the specifics of how they got there wrong, but but that's the general gist of who cares.
Grandma Belt, she her and
thank you so much.
One of her sisters were in Memphis for some reason.
Okay.
And they were at Graceland. And this was in the 50s at some point. This is, I guess, not too long after he bought Graceland. Yeah. And they were at the gate and the gate was open. And her sister, I can't remember who it was, Aunt Mardell or Mary Jo, but they were talking to Uncle Bester, who was always at the gate, usually. Mm-hmm. And while she was talking to him, well, Grandma just walked up the driveway all the way up to the house. And she knocked on the door, and she said someone opened the door. It was one of the Memphis Mafia guys, I guess. No telling who it was. And she said... And they said, well, who are you? And she said, well, I'm Anita, and I'm here to meet Elvis. I wanted to meet Elvis. And I said, oh, well, he's not here right now, but they were having a party, she said, inside. It looked like they were just having a big old party. And he said, he's not here right now, but you're welcome to come on inside if you want to and join us. And she said, well, I'm not that kind of lady. I just came here to meet Elvis.
That is fantastic.
And before she could get inside, Uncle Vester came speeding up the driveway and said, what are you doing? You're going to get me fired. I'm going to lose my job. You know,
that's so, so funny.
Took her back down to the...
Oh, anyway, that's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic. Hey, you know, what we do to meet our heroes, you know what I mean?
But no, you're talking about school, though, and I would... In high school, I would walk around. I had Peter Gurelnik has a book called Last Train to Memphis. And I spent a whole school year walking around with that book, reading that book in class. Yeah. No, Elvis was a big influence vocally. And I love singers like that, Tom Jones.
Oh.
I love Sinatra and Dean Martin. I love Tony Bennett. I love vocalists. Mm-hmm.
How would you, at this point in your life, is that what you, and this might, even just these words coming out of my mouth, I can hear, I don't know how I feel about that, but do you think of yourself at this point in life as a vocalist, or do you think of yourself as, how do you, if you were to kind of pigeonhole yourself at this point, like, what do you find that you feel is what you do?
Sure. Well, you know, I love the big vocalists, like I mentioned, but I also love country crooners and singers, you know. I love Merle Haggard's voice. He was an influence.
I love Merle's voice, yeah.
Charlie Rich, I love his voice. I love George Jones. You know, Waylon Jennings said if we could all sing the way we wanted to, we'd all sound like George Jones. And nobody is singing like him. But it's also about the emotion that you're conveying, the emotion mm-hmm. that you're putting into the song. But do I consider myself a vocalist? Yes, I consider myself, I think of myself as being more of a vocalist, a singer, more than a lyricist or a songwriter, mm-hmm. you know. I love the creative process. I've always been inspired by harmonies. I love the Beach Boys. Brian Wilson just passed away. I was obsessed for a minute with the Beach Boys and harmony. And,
that's fantastic.
And the Beatles. So I love creative artists like that, you know, mm-hmm. Rubber Soul or yeah. Pet Sounds and those kind of albums.
We just had, just a couple weeks ago, we had a buddy of ours in here who is a... I say a buddy because everyone who comes in here becomes a buddy of ours, you know? But he is a great vibraphone player, and he came in here. He did an arrangement of some Brian Wilson stuff, which
that's
was awesome.
Cool, yeah,
because it was like right after he had passed, and yeah, there's so many great harmonies on those records.
Oh yeah, incredible.
Yeah, and especially into the Beatles too of that era. I mean, Sgt. Pepper's. I mean, all of that stuff has got some phenomenal harmonies on it. But
there's mind blowing. Stuff for sure.
How do you because at this point, you know, you've in the last little while you've put out a few singles, you're kind of like you said, you're working towards an EP and hoping to get some other stuff coming out soon. At this point in your life as a recording artist, how do you approach the production of what you're making? Because it does have a very it does harken back to that 90s country sound, but mm-hmm. it's got other stuff going on there. What's your approach to how you tackle stuff in the studio?
Well, that goes back to what I was going to get at earlier with the, some people, they like the analog mm-hmm. and the old school way of recording, and it's got to be like that so they can sound just like the 1970s, or just, they want to capture that same kind of sound that they had back then. Excuse me. A little gassy.
these things, I love these things. And one, Topo Chico, if you're listening, sponsor us. But dear God,
they're the worst things
on a podcast. Oh my God,
we still drink them anyway.
Constantly burping.
It's, exactly.
Like,
it's so funny.
Sure
I'm like, this is the worst decision we could make. But you know what? Fuck it. They're so good. I don't care. There's a sweet spot, I think, with that. Like, you can, I do love the sound of particular recordings. I love the sound of recording to tape. I think this is just the approach that I like to take with music. I like it in the room. I like it live. All of my Brian's playing on all my records, all mm-hmm. three of them, we just cut them live in the room. Whatever mm-hmm. it is, that's what you get. And there are some overdubs here and there, but mm-hmm. that's it. But I love recording to digitally. I love all of the pros in the pro con call.
Yeah.
So much outweigh the inverse. That being said, I think if you can master the tape, or if you can master in a way that gets you in the ballpark of that sound, which this is going to sound, you know, sacrilege to some people listening, but I do think if you can master to tape or get it in some way, shape, or form into that ballpark sonically, you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Sure.
I really do, because I just think recording digitally, you have so much control, and not even, again, mm-hmm. not in the sense that like I'm not auto-tuning my voice or going back, or like, you know, we're not splicing takes or anything like that, but just the workflow itself is so much easier digitally. And
mm-hmm. for sure,
obviously there are people who are incredibly competent at recording to tape and can be just wizards at that, like anything. But I just think it's so fucking nice that we live in 2025.
Yeah.
Like, it's so nice.
So my whole thing is, honestly, I have a lot of respect for that, recording the old school way and doing mm-hmm. that. But my thought is, the guys, Waylon in the 1970s, he was recording with the latest, greatest high-tech equipment.
Exactly, yeah.
Because he wanted it to sound new and fresh. Mm-hmm. He wasn't sitting there going, hey, let's record with equipment from the 1930s so we sound like those guys. And this, that'd be a great sound for this album.
Fucking Carter family
and I don't mean
sounded
that.
Great. No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really, I'm not trying to be disrespectful when I say that.
There's something beautiful about that, but it's just,
But for me, personally, just write a good, I mean, it's about the song being a good song. If you just have a good damn song, write a good damn song and then record it with, I want to record with the latest, greatest tech. I want to record with the latest, newest stuff because I want it to sound new and fresh. And there's so much, like you're saying, there's so much that you can do with that. I mean, Brian Wilson, if he was around today, he'd be using everything that he could.
Yeah. I mean, just what he managed. So people don't realize so much. I think we talked about this a little bit a couple weeks ago when once he had passed, but he was doing so much of that on 4-track. It's insane.
Yeah.
Like what he could do at the time on fucking 4-track is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane.
Yeah, it is wild to think about like some of that particularly in that era.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like what they accomplished with the technology they had is very impressive.
Yeah.
It's very hard to recreate that.
It's hard to recreate that now with the technology you have, let alone at that time.
Then, when it's all new.
That all of that being said, and I completely 100% agree, I do also think, and I think there's other ways that you can sort of control for this, but I do think creatively there is something about giving yourself limitations. Mm-hmm. There's something about knowing where the ceiling is and kind of feeling where you're at. Yeah. And then having the ability, the skills to push and maneuver where you feel you need to in order to make what you're looking to make the thing that you're looking to make.
Yeah.
And I do really think that giving yourself restrictions is not just a good thing. I think it's a complete necessity. I think you need to be able to feel where the edges are. I just, again, that might just be for me how I best work creatively, but I really truly think that if you can approach it in that way, where you give yourself that level of structure, but then also recognize that these edges are malleable, and we can if I really want to push in this direction, we can go in this direction. Mm-hmm. I do find that, again, this is coming from an idiot, I do think that that's what yields the best results, is giving yourself that structure and then being able to play around with the framework.
Yeah, that's smart. Yeah,
it's a hard, again, it's like all of this stuff. It's a hard balancing act to juggle because limitations
are going to push more creativity.
Exactly. And I do feel like that is one of the, you know, not to make this in any way cynical, but I do think that is one of the downsides of, being a creative person in 2025 is it seems like everything's on the table, which is great. I mean, and I would much rather live in that world where seemingly everything is on the table than, you know, recording in 1925, 100%. But it's a different list of cons in the cons column. Mm-hmm. And I think people need to be aware of that. Cause oftentimes if you're not aware of that, it can come back to kind of bite you in the ass. Cause it does. It just feels like everything's on the table. How do you, even though that is your approach to recording, and I think that's at least in my mind, the healthiest, best approach you can possibly take. How do you manage to control for those cons of everything being on the table? How do you kind of focus up what you're doing and serve the song like you're talking about?
Man, that's a good question.
Because Brian and I talk about this a lot. I mean, I think the thing that both of us are most impressed with in any form of music is when people can just serve the song.
Right.
And just get out of the way of the song. And sometimes that means a flashy guitar solo. Maybe that means crazy production. So, you know, sometimes it's on the table, but.
No, for me, I think when you're going into the studio, you want to give the musicians, first of all, you want to just let them play and not try to control what they're doing, you know, bring in their natural talents and their natural instinct and allow them to move in whatever direction they feel. I'm like you with the process of when you go into the studio, I want to record all at the same time, do the full, and limit the overdubs, amount of overdubs, even the amount of vocal takes that we did. For what we just recently did, I only did, I think, maybe two of the songs. I went in and a couple of the songs and redid the vocals, but everything else was pretty much done. So we didn't even really do many overdub, you know, vocal overdubs. So a lot of it's just straight live. But yeah, man, what a question. Brian did a good job.
Brian Simpson.
Brian Simpson producing. and keeping everybody in track. And but the creative process for them, just letting those musicians, you know, follow mm-hmm. where it's taking them. That's the magic for me.
Yeah, I think if there's any through line that I can find in my favorite musical minds, and that can range from, you know, Miles Davis to Bob Dylan, what they are incredibly good at, mm-hmm. amongst other things, mm-hmm. is recognizing the skills they have in the room, mm-hmm. and being able to guide for that. You might have a very clear idea of what you want, or you might have a very hazy idea of what you want, but being able to allow the people that have these skill sets around you to utilize those skill sets, mm-hmm. whilst being hyper aware of the thing that you're sculpting for in your mind. Right. And those people are, there are people who are phenomenal. Like, to me, that's the skill set that I want to acquire for myself. And that I really try to, because I do, just like you're saying, I think you need to let people come to the table with their strong suits. And your job as a, you know, whether you want to call it a band leader, producer, whatever, is to just sort of guide the ship.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, I mean, that is, again, in any world of music, I think that's what yields the best results, mm-hmm. because you can have these beautiful creative conversations musically, whilst getting exactly the thing that you want in a weird way.
Yeah.
It's this beautiful balance that I think is very, very hard to, it's very hard to articulate, but we've all been in a room where that's happening, and you just think, God, I wish this take could go on forever. I wish this jam could just go on forever, because we're all working towards that singular vision. And usually you need one person who can kind of be at the steering wheel and mm-hmm. direct, but very subtly.
Right. Yeah. And I feel like that's what we did. And, of course, the beginning of the process, Brian will ask, well, is there sound out there? What tracks out there have that sound that you're trying to capture? Yeah. Or what are you hearing in your head? Give me an example. So I would send him a list of songs. And so he forwarded that to each one of them. So they already had an idea of where we were going, what direction.
What the dialect is, like what right. language you're speaking.
Basically. Sure. And
that's a great way to do it.
For example, for my stuff, before we went into the studio, what's something that sonically sounds similar to what you're wanting to capture, what you're hearing? Yeah. I sent him David Ball's 1995 Thinking Problem album.
Oh, nice.
And that's one of my most favorite albums of all time. And I said, this is what I need to listen to that.
I need to listen to that. Hell yeah.
Yeah, it's
that's why the show's fucking great, because then I get all of these.
I've gotten so many good music recommendations from this. Yeah.
It's the best.
Yeah, David Ball, the Thinking Problem album from 1995 is his best album, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And incredible stuff on it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. What, I guess, kind of pivoting from music a little bit here. So you've had a relationship with Nashville and with Tennessee for a while. Like,
yeah.
Is outside of just music, like what's kept you around here for this, or coming back here for all this time? Like
outside of music, not much. Not much else outside of music.
Brian and I joke around about it. Like, don't get me wrong, we enjoy Nashville. But I mean, I think, you know, don't get me wrong, the scene here is great. The music scene here, it does have its benefits, and it's one of the reasons why we can do something like this.
Yeah.
But I think we enjoy Tennessee more than we enjoy Nashville. You know what I mean?
Okay,
so I think for us, it's like, you know, we just kind of like living in Tennessee, but, you know, Nashville's kind of a perk.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love the hills of Tennessee. One thing, it's kind of funny, people always have allergy issues. They move here and they suddenly have allergies. I have fortunately been the exact opposite.
Really?
Where back home in Texas, there's ragweed that I'm allergic to.
Oh.
And so growing up and throughout high school and everything, I always had allergy issues and problems, and I grew up with migraine headaches and such. But I come here to Nashville, to Tennessee, and it clears up.
That's amazing.
And I don't have... So that's one thing.
There you go. That's what's kept you around.
I never had any allergies until I moved here.
Until you moved here?
Now in the spring, I get destroyed.
Brian lived in SoCal his whole life. Okay, I lived out there for a while during high school age. So, you know, but I was a little more nomadic than him. So that honestly, that probably kind of sucks, really, just going from one environment for the majority of your life to something. Nashville can be, or Tennessee can be kind of rough. My dog, I just put my dog down not long ago, but he had bad allergies.
Sorry to hear that, by the way.
I appreciate it. But, he had some bad allergies his whole life because of living out here. It can be rough. Yeah. Rough for some people, but no pun intended.
Rough. Knee slapper.
It's a fun part of the country. How does culturally, we love Texas. I mean, we've it's been a while since I've spent any real time out there. The first time Brian and I really were in Texas for any serious amount of time was probably about 6 years ago, maybe a little longer. We did a 2 or 3 week run out there and just went all over Texas and fell in love with it. I mean, neither of us had, other than driving through, neither of us had really spent any time out there.
Another place I get horrific allergies.
Yeah.
At both times, I've gone to Austin twice, both times got like violent allergies.
Makes sense. Being said, Brian and I both really enjoy Texas.
It is.
Great
out there.
What is it? How do you find that Tennessee stacks up against Texas, just kind of culturally? What's the difference?
They're pretty similar, but Tennessee, Nashville.
Nashville's also just very different than
Nashville's like Austin. Like Seattle is. I mean, it's there's a lot of weird and interesting and
and sometimes beautiful, you know,
and sometimes not. I mean, Nashville is just such a. There's so many people from everywhere else here. I don't know how many people do I actually know that are from here. I don't even know.
You
know, it's like, but at Texas, the same thing is kind of happening, I guess, there now. In the past several years, there's been a lot of people moving straight to Texas.
I've heard even more so than Tennessee. Texas is really blowing up.
It really is.
Yeah, it seemed like we kind of hit our limit a handful of years ago, and then all those excess went to Austin instead.
But culturally interesting. I was surprised with what a strong Hispanic population and culture we have here in this area in Tennessee, as I mean it's very strong in Texas. And so that to be in Nashville is interesting for me when I first moved here. Thinking about just the similarities, they're pretty similar. There's a connection between Tennessee and Texas that's lasted for a long time.
I think I'm probably hype. So my dad was in the Marine Corps growing up, so I lived all over the place. And so I'm probably hyper aware of things like that just because, you know, when you are nomadic in that sense, it kind of makes you pay attention to certain things. But I was very surprised. I think coming out here, for one, I just sort of missed this part of the country. I never lived in Tennessee before, but I missed living in this part of the country. And I do think that one of the things I was surprised about was the, you know, I lived in Southern California like Brian for a while. And obviously there's a huge crossover between there and Mexico. And I was very surprised that there's a lot of that here too. Like there's a lot of different, there's a lot of bleed over in ways I didn't really anticipate.
Sure.
But the people here are so, so nice. I mean, the people here, it's one of the things that I really enjoy about, you know, don't get me wrong. East Coast people are great. You know, we talked about before we started rolling, Brian and I lived in Boston prior to coming out here. And, you know, like my family's all originally from Pittsburgh. You know, that there's something endearing and great about those people.
Are you a Steelers fan?
I am. I'm not a football guy, but when it's football season, I, you know, gun to my head, I have to root for the Steelers. And by gun to my head, I mean my family's gun to my head.
I only ask because I'm a Cowboys fan.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Well, you know, door's right there, buddy. No, I do think, you know, East Coast people, they are very direct. They're very in your face. You know, again, in my mind, I'm kind of contrasting this to Boston, New York, you know, that whole sort of segment of the country. Mm-hmm. Great, great people in a lot of ways, but very, very, which is what I missed. I mean, don't get me wrong, this is not me, you know, this is not the shitting on California segment of the show, but kind of is. That's one of the reasons why I never really liked California as a young person, is because the culture there is so different. Mm-hmm. And
people are much more reserved.
Are much more reserved. And yeah. all of the friends that I made living out in California the years I was out there were all East Coast transplants. Mm. And I think a lot of it's just a personality thing. Like some people, you know, the people that I tend to be drawn to are more, maybe not boisterous, but more forward, kind of friendly personalities. Yeah. Where that's just generally not the way Californians, or you know, at least that segment of Cal, because California is really like five states, you know. That's just generally not the way that those people are, and
there's a lot of them here.
Yeah, exactly. And there's way too many of us out here. But that's the thing that I love about out here, and also Texas as well, is it does feel a lot more open and friendly. It's very different than the East Coast, obviously, but much more akin to them in the sense that people just want to have a conversation with you, mm-hmm. which I enjoy. I like that sort of friendly approach that people have to one another out here. But
you're gonna have how you doing, darling? You know, tell me about your day. You know,
yeah, like it's I'm sure it's a personality thing. I'm sure there's some people who like living where nobody wants to, you know, looking in the eye when you walk down the street. But like, that's not my thing. You know, that's not my thing.
Yeah. Right. No, I totally get that. Yeah. But, between Tennessee and Texas, there's not a whole lot of difference,
yeah,
really,
when
you get down
similar.
To the southern roots of it. You know, you do have that same thing. People tell me that when they come to Nashville, it's still shocking for them, you know, how outgoing mm-hmm. people are, and they're more kind than, let's say, you know, up north.
And I think also too out here, one of the things I've been very surprised at, because again, we've only been here 7 years now, so we haven't been here the longest time in the world, but I think everyone can sort of acknowledge that there's been a big shift in the last 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. at least that I've recognized, of just so many people coming out here. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think has been really wonderful is, as much as there's been quite a large influx of new folks coming out to the scene here, for whatever reason, everyone seems to have kind of acclimated. Everyone sort of read the room well.
Yeah.
And understood,
sure.
Okay, this is where I'm coming to. I mean, obviously, like anything, there's going to be shift when you have that amount of people mm-hmm. moving into a new place. But it does seem like people have generally read the room really well and sort of acclimated to what Nashville is and what
That's
Tennessee
true.
Is, which is, which I think is really beautiful and unique. And people kind of recognize, now I'm moving here for a reason because I want to be there. You know what I mean?
And people forget too that there's so much more here than just music too.
Oh, I mean,
it's more of a medical. I think the number one industry here is medical,
is
right?
Huge. Yeah. And, I mean, obviously tech is coming up too the last few years, but yeah, medical's mm-hmm. massive here.
And I guess the tourism, sports too. We've mm-hmm. got the soccer now. We've got a soccer team, and we've got the. Mm-hmm.
Aren't they like
football.
Trying to get a baseball team?
Trying to get a baseball
that's what
team.
I heard.
I'd be down for that. See, that's mm-hmm. my only sport that I really follow is MMA. I love MMA, but I used to be a big baseball fan as a kid.
Yeah, me too.
And so, to me, it's like the only pro sport that I go to that like I love going to a baseball game.
Me too.
I just there's something about it I just fucking
it's
love.
It's nostalgic.
It is. It's also like I could sit here and talk forever about MMA or baseball. I just think there's something so beautiful about. I think there's something so beautiful about the sport of baseball as a sport. It's so unique. It's such a singular American thing.
Yeah, it is.
That's so beautiful. But I would love if we got an MLB team here. I think that'd be amazing.
I would be pretty stoked about it myself. Yeah. I know there's people that don't care about it and don't want it, but you know, I'd be pretty happy about it.
Just get rid of the fucking football stadium or whatever and like, you know, just put this.
Man, that thing is, I'm amazed by that.
Yeah, no, it's
and
wild.
Putting it right in the middle of town.
It's very
wild. It looks like it's going to look like a big black box.
Yeah, no, it's very, very strange.
Oh,
just
really?
Kind of
That's
an interesting,
kind of wild.
Yeah.
I heard
they're
going to put like a whole shopping mall down there.
Yeah, really? I didn't hear that.
It's going to be, like, if you ever look up like the development plans for that area, it's going to like be pretty crazy. They're putting a whole lot of shit in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nashville skyline is, it's funny. I don't think about it as much. So I live in East Nashville.
Drastic.
And again, even in the time we've been here, it's changed immensely. But I think, you know, when you see it every day, like anything, you kind of get desensitized to it. But every time that I have folks come in and you know, friends, family stay with me, whatever, everyone points out how beautiful the Nashville skyline is, because it truly, truly is. And I just, it is strange how much in the short time that we've been here, it has changed. And I'm sure it's going to change immensely in the next few years. But I hope they can retain the beauty of it, because it really is a stunning, stunning skyline.
It's incredible, the growth rate, you know, and the real estate and the geez. But yeah, the
pricey.
I just saw pricey. And yeah, that too. But there was a photo from 2014 to 2024 showing the skyline and how much it drastically has changed.
Oh, yeah. Even just in the past, like, 2 or 3 years, like, I'll be driving through town, I'm like, I swear that skyscraper was not here a year ago.
I contrast everything to the Batman building. Like, everything is against the AT&T building. You know what I mean? And it's like everything is slowly creeping up.
It is, yeah.
Especially like on Church Street, all those big ass buildings over there where like the new Pinnacle building is and shit. Yeah. If you compare that to even like 3 years ago, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
They build fast here.
Yeah, baseball. Let's go. Let's get an MLB team in here. The fun part will be us naming that team. Because God knows we're gonna have some
The Sounds games?
I do. The Sounds games are a lot of fun.
Yeah,
they're a lot of fun.
You naming the team, though, that's funny you said that, because I love to play. So I've got a PS4. I haven't upgraded to the 5 yet, but
they just got a 5.
We just got a PS5.
Oh, did you? Yeah. What do you think? You like it?
So far, we haven't gotten too many games, but
yeah,
it's been fun. We bought it in preparation for Grand Theft Auto 6 coming out. we had to be ready for it when it came out.
Isn't that still like another year away?
I know, but you know,
that's hilarious.
Get prepared early.
Yeah. Gotta get those thumbs ready.
I'm not a big gamer or anything, but I like. And I'm very basic. Okay, I like the baseball and I like the Madden games.
Oh, there you go. That's the way to be.
Race car game. I mean, so one of the MLB games that I had, you can create your own team.
Oh yeah.
Well, I created my own baseball team and I called them the Nashville Stars.
Okay.
And then one of those first reports came out that they were thinking about having a ball team here, they said the name they're considering is the Nashville Stars.
That's wild.
I thought that is so funny.
That's like a movie where it's like everything that you do in your fucking video game starts to come true.
Come true.
Like, oh my god, it's like a Bill Murray movie or something.
There's a Ryan Reynolds movie where he's a character in a video game. What is that called?
I want to say Ready Player One, but it's a different one.
Oh, no, yeah.
No, yeah.
Oh, that's a good movie. That's Spielberg.
Yeah, that's... Oh, God, what is that movie? I know exactly what you're talking about. That's hilarious. It would be fun to have a ball team here. We'll see if that happens. But, yeah, my relationship with video games is really just like Super Smash Brothers on the Super Nintendo. You know what I mean? Like, that's my thing.
Can't beat the classics.
Exactly.
I remember Atari.
Oh, there you go.
That was long before my time.
I think we rented one. My parents rented
an
Atari. We either rented it or borrowed it. I think they rented it. But I remember having one at the house for just a hot second there before. Then Nintendo came out not too much longer after that.
Yeah. Some of those, like the Super Nintendo ones, oh, man, like the Mario Super, what was the one? I'm trying to think of that. It was a Super Mario World, right?
I think so.
That's one of my favorite games ever. That one's so, so fun.
Duck Hunt.
Yeah. All my siblings were big into... as a kid, obviously, I loved video games. And as I got a little older and got obsessed with other things, I just don't really... Other than like Super Smash or Mario Kart, which Brian and I will throw down in. Other than that, my video game exposure is pretty limited. But my brothers were always big into it. They build their own computers and shit. My dad's the same way as you guys. He'll buy the new PlayStation 5 or whatever it is and just like sit there and be like playing Call of Duty or whatever. Yeah. And then inevitably I'll go home to visit and they'll be playing it and I'll like, oh, I'll give it a shot. And of course, 4 hours get sucked into like, it's kind of the fucking best though. I'm not going to lie. I'm just such an addictive personality with anything.
Do you really?
Yeah. Like I need to pick my like, you know, six things in life.
Sure.
Because if I, as soon as I grab it, it's like, so Brian in the last little while, Brian and Alexa, probably the last couple of years have really gotten into golf. That's been Brian's big thing.
And I can't get into golf, man.
They'll have me come out to the, every once in a while I'll come out and play with, and it's so much fun. I fucking love it. It's a ball. It's such a difficult thing to do. I love it. But it's one of those things where I'm like, and Brian is exactly the same way as myself. Brian will just get addicted to shit. He is an addictive personality like me.
Hyper focused,
And so for like 2 years now, it's like, okay, I'm getting good at golf. And Brian's got really fucking good golf. And I wouldn't
go that far.
You've gotten a lot better at golf. I'll put it like that. Like people would be very impressed to watch you golf, I'll say.
I don't think so.
But for myself, it's like, I can't do it. Cause then all I'm going to want to do is golf for 2 years. You know?
Yeah, there's worse things to get.
There's worse things.
That's true. That's true.
Well, don't take me golfing. That's all I had to say is because I'm not a golfer.
So what's up with UFOs, dude? You ever seen?
We're gonna get to that.
You ever seen one?
Oh, dude, we're getting to there we go. Let's go. Getting to UFOs. Yeah, I was going to ask.
Like, you've been waiting for that. You've been holding on.
Ready for this?
Loaded gun over there. Let's go. Okay, so Brian, some context.
Okay.
Brian, I am the most, I don't want to say skeptical, but skeptical person with a lot of things like that, right?
Yeah.
Not that I don't believe that that's possible. Brian is a full-fledged believer. He's like, let's go.
During COVID, there was a lot of nothing to do. So yeah. At one point I went deep down the UFO rabbit hole and I don't follow too much anymore, but there's some compelling shit out there.
There is. I fell into that rabbit hole, especially over the pandemic. So I know what you're talking about.
I think a lot of people did.
Yeah,
I'm over here. I'm trying to think of X-Files references over here. I'm like the whatever. Never mind.
Scully.
I'm the Scully to his Mulder.
Yeah, Mulder. Yeah.
I'm the skeptical one over here, but.
Yeah, well, I
that was a hard pivot, Brian. Jesus.
I know,
that
was a hard pivot. Someone had to do it.
But yes, I
so what
I
are
have.
You besides music? What are you into? Are you into aliens?
That's true. I love sci-fi content and stuff like that. But no, I don't know how it started. I've kind of had a fascination with this stuff since my childhood. But no, in 2001, I was working at South Fork Ranch. If you know the TV show Dallas. Anyway, the TV show Dallas.
That was pretty good, actually. Yeah. That was good.
Well, we grew up, you know, it was always on TV. Yeah. But I worked at that ranch. So when
that's
that,
really cool.
That the scene where they're coming in over the top of the ranch, that's the ranch where I worked.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
And it's in Parker, Texas. Okay. My buddy, my best friend in school, his name was Patrick. He was working there, and he helped me get a job out there. And I was working on the maintenance team, but I was also a singing cowboy. So
that's the dream. That's every country artist's dream, right there.
It was fun. Yeah. It was. Patrick would bring his horses. He'd have his horses out there. Now they called it, you know, Southwick Ranch, but it wasn't an actual working ranch. Okay. You know, it was a museum. They had a museum set up so you could take a tour through that and tour the house and all that. And they had some longhorns and a couple of horses and things, but it wasn't serious. But Patrick would bring his horses out, and they would have groups from Germany and Japan and just any from the UK. They would come out and take a tour, and then they would do a hay wagon where they would ride out into the middle of the field. And we'd have a chuck wagon set up already out there. And they'd sit down on the hay bales I'm getting to it.
No.
But they would sit out there and
so when do the aliens come?
Right. But we were right out there on the horses and say, you know, they'd be like, oh, who goes there? You know, the whole thing. And we'd ride out and I'd have my guitar and sing there, I've got spurs, and jingle, 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 you know. So anyway, So one night we did all that, and afterwards he was taking the horses back, and I was going out to my truck, and I'm sitting back in my truck, or it was his truck. I was laying in the bed of the truck just looking up at the stars, and I noticed that it looked like one of them was moving. And I just started to focus in on it, and it looked like the game of Pong, where it just kind of floats. It looked like it was floating. It just kind of moves over here, and then boom, kind of goes over here, and then boom, shot off and went away. And that's what I saw.
That's incredible.
Completely. I mean, it's anticlimactic. You know, it's not anything exciting, but it's that's what I saw.
That's crazy.
The thing that I do find compelling about a lot of stuff, and it's also the thing that also in my mind makes it not as compelling, strangely enough, it's almost a double-edged sword. How similar a lot of the how similar the stories are for a lot of people.
Yeah,
I mean, and obviously, you know, if that's something in the zeitgeist, if that's something out there, then that can manifest in different ways. Mm-hmm. But it is, I do find that compelling that a lot of that stuff is very, very similar.
Well, the confirmation for me was because I was thinking to myself, am I crazy or did I just see what I saw? But I didn't really tell anybody about it ever, and until years later. And when I came back to Texas and was reconnecting with my friend Patrick, we went out to dinner and we were talking about Southfort Ranch, and I told him the story, and I told him, man, I saw this, and he said, I saw the same thing. And I said, you're kidding me. You saw the same, after all these years, we've never talked about this, and you saw the same thing. He said, yeah, I saw it too.
That's amazing.
And, so that confirmed it, first of all, that I wasn't crazy. Yeah. I wasn't seeing things. And so, you know, and that's really what got me. And then after that, I really did have a lot more interest in that topic.
And it's such a compelling thing. And at least for myself, I don't think there's any way that there's not stuff out there.
Sure.
My only reservation is I think I'm surprised that if it is out there and we have had contact in some way, that it's not more widespread. That being said, I mean, I just don't think that there's a world where there isn't stuff out there.
But Robert Bigelow says they walk among us, so we'll
one,
see.
One surprise me, you know? Brian's got a weird look in his eye sometimes, you know?
You know Robert Bigelow, right?
Sounds familiar.
Well, he owned Skinwalker Ranch for a minute.
Okay, yeah.
And he was working with the government to investigate the paranormal activity that was happening. And Skinwalker Ranch, there's stuff been going on there for a long time, you know, since the 90s.
Yeah.
But
Brian will start throwing stuff my way.
Hasn't the government, basically admitted that they've, come in contact with extraterrestrial craft? And
they've had a congressional hearing where David Grush and some other whistleblowers have come forward and said that we do have the technology. And we've retrieved craft, and we have craft retrieval programs, and we're picking up these things. And
it's crazy that that's not bigger news.
Yeah, right.
I feel like that happened, and then just nobody noticed.
So this has been going on since 2018. So
we were living together when all of this stuff was happening, and we were both pretty. My skepticism shines through here, not in a cynical way, but I just. Yeah, I think our dispositions as similar as Brian and I are different in this regard, where I just am so much more, I think it's hard for people to keep that, I think it's hard for it goes against the nature of human beings in a lot of ways to be that secretive with things.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, I always chalk up these things to just ignorance and to just people's inability to keep their mouth shut with things, because it's just who we are. You know, we like this. We like that level of gossip and interaction. And
it's fun.
I know it is. Yeah. It's fun. Yeah. It's fun. I think that's just naturally what we are as a people. And that being said, there obviously historically there have been major secrets that have been kept and housed.
There's some pretty big secrets.
Yeah, really. Exactly. So it's like I understand. Like historically, that absolutely has happened in the past.
Yeah.
But it is the exception to the rule, not the rule. But it'd be fucking cool if they're aliens. So.
I don't know. Maybe I've been a Star Trek fan since I was a child, and that's probably part of that has, you know, curated this fascination that I have. But man, a lot's been happening. Y'all know Tom DeLonge.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom of Blink 182. Mm-hmm. Y'all should have him on the show.
Very fun.
That'd be cool.
Talk about,
let's go. That'd be a tough one to get.
But. Yeah, that'd be a tough one to get. But no,
I don't know if I saw he did like a podcast that I listened to, and I don't. He does the whole thing a lot of UFO people do, yeah. Where it's like, oh, there's like big information coming soon. And
I can't tell you about it.
I can't talk about this right now, but it's like,
that constant, and then they just keep being dangled.
Yeah. And they just keep kind of pushing the ball down the road.
That's where I started to get kind of frustrated and tired of that.
I think that world kind of like breeds a lot of people just like grifting and.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
definitely.
It's always coming soon. Yeah. Like. Real soon.
Yes. Well, they say 2027 is the year.
Yeah, and then
interesting. Yeah.
They'll give you a little breadcrumb and then push the date further back.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, that's how it always goes.
That's how it always happens.
And you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna golf in the meantime. So there you go.
Golfing with aliens.
Well, yeah, exactly. There you go. Honestly, what? So outside of aliens, what is it? What is it that you really enjoy doing in life at this point? No, I feel like as silly as it sounds, there's no reason to really write and perform, right? The only reason that we do this is something calling in us that wants us to sort of project into the world, right? Because that's what art is us looking at our own reflection, right? Mm-hmm. But we need something to be reflected back at us. Like, what is it that you're enjoying in life at this point outside of music?
Enjoying outside of life. Well, I mean, you know, music is, I'm completely consumed by it. It's my everyday wake up and go. But outside of that, you know, as far as hobbies go, I like to exercise. I like to go hiking. I like that kind of stuff. But my interests and fascinations, I'm trying to figure out how do I get into this. No, I'm into mycology.
Oh.
Mycelia. I find mushrooms and psychedelics and that topic to be incredibly fascinating. I'm a big Terrence McKenna fan. I read a lot of books about that topic and that subject. I'm fascinated I'm curious of how that connects to religion and how we got to where we are today with our religious beliefs. And I believe that psychedelics have been a big influence in that, or that's at least a hypothesis that I...
It's such a compelling hypothesis, though. I mean, I really, and again, it's a hypothesis, but it's so compelling.
Yeah.
I don't know how more people don't acknowledge it to a greater extent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting.
There's something to it, for sure.
Yeah. And there's some new developments that have occurred recently with a discovery of ergot being in the chalices of
I heard about that.
That Brian Marescu wrote a great book called The Immortality Key, and he was an attorney, a lawyer, and he left law in order to go on this journey, this search for ergot, and vindicate Carl Ruck and these other guys that had been searching for this for Albert Hofmann for years. The evidence that Eleusis, the rituals of Eleusis in Greece, were that they were using psychedelics or some form of a psychedelics in their kukion, their kakion, that they drink, the potion. And they denied it for so long, and they still, I think, do. But they have discovered and found that there was indeed ergot, which is basically a form of LSD. It's a mold. The forms on wheat, and that was found in one of the chalices in Spain, where there was a colony of Greeks that existed there. And so, what happened was he went to Greece first to try to find these chalices, and they found the chalices. They had them, but they had washed and cleaned them, so there was no. They couldn't do any kind of studies to try to find traces of ergot. So that was he felt like he had come to the end of the road, and he didn't have any hope left. And then they found out about this colony that was in Spain, and they were conducting those rituals there, and they found the chalices, and lo and behold, they had ergot in them. And so Karl Ruck was felt you know, very vindicated about that. But what does that tell you, though? That tells you that there were indeed psychedelics used in those rituals, and how does that influence religion as far as, you know, going forward from that point
and
on?
And even going back further than that, how has it influenced the development of the human brain?
I mean, one
of the great mysteries, I say mysteries, but one of the great, you know, one of the great puzzles to be solved is how in such a short period of time, the human brain developed in the manner in which it did. And I'm sure that we'll get closer to understanding a fuller picture of that over time, but I can't imagine a world where that's not at least a major part of it.
Well, Terence McKenna, his hypothesis is the stoned ape theory. Mm-hmm. And where, as we evolved and developed, we ate mushrooms as hunter-gatherers, and it sharpened our instincts. Mm-hmm. Our vision became sharper. We became better hunters. And procreation, and you know, inspires that, you know, sex, and yeah, you know, have, and so you have this, you start growing and developing and expand your brain when you're on psychedelics, mushrooms, you know, create new neural links in your brain. So it's really fascinating. I think it definitely did help evolve us in some way.
It's one of those things too, where contemporarily something like that may seem on the fringes and may seem, and I know, just again, so the in general contemporary cultures, those ideas can seem on the fringes, but that's how all major, there's this weird thing culturally that happens that I don't understand, where people can see something, can come in contact with an idea like that, that can seem on the fringes, and yet not recognize that everything that they understand about the world around them had been at one point or another those ideas on the fringes, whether it's evolution, just the basic fundamentals of evolution, whether it's anything in the world, you can view it through that lens. And it's this strange disconnect that I think people have with the world around them, which I don't fully understand. 'Cause something like that is such a basic idea, and yet it explains so much in my mind, at least, again, as someone who's not, my background is not in this kind of thing. As an idiot, it explains a lot of sort of basic questions that we have about the development of human beings and the development of the world. And I, to me, it's even more interesting just how people interface with ideas like that, and why there is such disconnect between the things that may seem on the fringes in a moment, but can potentially become more mainstream. I don't know why people have a hard time with that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I just genuinely don't get it. And I also just think it's fascinating. I have this thing that I believe, and I think Brian and I have talked about this and kind of on the same page. I do feel like so much of human existence is cyclical. And it's not to say that, you know, we had flying cars and shit like that, but like, I do think that it ebbs and flows, and there are times of great progress and there are times of great collapse, and that these things kind of fall into themselves.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm just fascinated by all of the ways in which human beings interplay with every, I mean, so for me, like I love tobacco. I love pipe tobacco and cigars. Like, that's just, I don't drink anymore. I don't even drink caffeine anymore. So like, I'm boring. I've got like cigars, you know.
Sure. No, that's
and,
fine.
And I just am fascinated by the history of human beings and tobacco, and how that has over hundreds and thousands of years has been just a part of our interplay with the world, and how, you know, and how those things have interplayed with our relationship to geography, and just it's such an interesting thing. But we're not the first people to have this relationship with this part of the world. Right. And there are so many other elements of life where that's the case. And I just, there's this weird ego thing that I think is just inside of most people. Whereas you think that, I can't even quite put my finger on it, but it is just this feeling of, this is how things are now, but it's not how things always have. It's like, no, every thought you've ever had someone before you has probably had it already. It might have manifested in a different way. The context of that situation may have been different, but you are living the same human experience that someone 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. I mean, it's the exact same human experience.
Yeah.
You just happen to be right now in the year 2025 in, you know, Tennessee, this weird disconnect that I think people have. That I don't fully understand. Maybe it is just an ego thing. Maybe it is just the ability to disconnect and recognize that you are much more insignificant than you like to think.
Yeah, no, we are much. That's one thing that psychedelics shows you, that you are.
Yes,
you know,
it's very good at that.
Yeah. Much smaller than you imagine yourself to be.
Tear down your ego real quick.
Yes, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
and that's what I love about it.
I think in art, it's so important.
It is important.
And I am sure that is incredibly effective in a lot of other things you want to tackle.
Oh, yeah.
But I think in art, it is just wholly important.
Incredibly important. No, and then, I mean, look at the music that's been inspired from.
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, but art in general.
We really took a nosedive with the cocaine era. You know what I mean? Once we got to that culture, it was like, okay, all bets are off.
No, right. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's true.
We went from the 70s to the 80s real fucking quick.
I don't know. I feel like there's something so important about that that everyone needs to be aware of and educated on. And we need to start teaching these things and making people aware. I feel like there should be in school, there should be classes about mycelium and the difference of mushrooms and these different things. They shouldn't be outlawed. These are not things.
Yeah.
They should be presented in a way of how they can help you and how they can benefit, how you can benefit from them in all the health ways. Mentally, you know, think of all the people who have been affected in war and post-traumatic syndrome and those things. They're helping soldiers.
They're starting to kind of like decriminalize them in a lot of states, right? Didn't Colorado legalize mushrooms?
I think so. Yeah, Colorado as well.
I think Oregon too, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to me, again, this is where Casey's, you know, my true colors start to come out too. But it's also, even if they were not to have these great benefits for some people, the idea of villainizing them in an inaccurate way, I think, is wrong. And regardless of that, and I also think telling people, demanding of people that they interact with these things in particular ways or not interact with them at all, I think is immoral as well. But again, that's just my crazy view of the world.
And there's the religious, you know, ideas
For sure.
As well, which, I mean, I think that they were used in religion, you know, the church used these things. As far as, I don't remember the source, but in Catholic Church, what are the things that they swing around? What do you call those things?
Oh, yeah.
They had the smoke that comes out of them.
Yes.
Now, I read somewhere that they once had cannabis inside
I've heard that as well, yeah.
And that's what they were burning.
And I think, I do think that there's a lot more crossover there than people would like to admit. I think with that kind of thing, anyone who has done some form of substance that has really altered your perception of the world understands that if anything, I think it only opens that door to religion and the unknown much wider because again, it keeps the ego in check in a way that your everyday life is just incapable of doing.
Right.
And I think a lot of people fear that that kind of thing will actually do the inverse. But I think practically speaking, it really does allow for that possibility in a much greater capacity than people really think.
Right.
Because it does strip the ego in such a major way that it allows people to see, that there is stuff outside of my mundane day-to-day life that is so vast and so beyond what I can even comprehend. The way I always think about it, I think of it like ants. You know what I mean? It's something I think about this all the time. I think that I've got recently in the last couple of weeks, this is such a dumb comparison, but I've had some ants come into the house. So I've had to, you know, put out ant traps and sprays and stuff. And I remember like looking at one of these guys crawling across my countertop and just thinking he is so unaware of the fact that I have the capacity to just end his life and that's over. And that's one less ant that I have to worry about.
Yeah.
And I do feel that that is the way that we interface with so much of existence.
Yeah.
It's no fault of our own. Mm-hmm. We just do not have the capability to even begin to fathom certain things outside of our understanding of the world. And not to say that those substances give us a full picture, but they can break the edges slightly, right? Yeah. Going back to what we were talking about with music, it's the exact same thing in my mind. You know where the edges are, but those edges are malleable and you can stretch those edges. And I think it's the same thing. You're never going to get, that ant is never going to understand what my perception of the world is, as I will never understand the perception beyond mine.
That ant will never understand that I'm about to pee my pants right now so bad.
we can close it. We can close it up.
I was going to say, I love everything you're saying, I'm so like, I'm enjoying it. I'm like, so trying to focus, but I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to pee my pants so bad right now.
we can wrap it up because we've been going for a while actually. But, I got to say, this has been an absolute ball. This has been so, so much fun. I'm so glad that we had the music was sounding fucking fantastic. I'm really excited to see how those turn out. Cause they sounded great.
Man, thank you.
What's next on the horizon real fast?
I feel like I've got so much more to talk about. I really do. But what's next? The EP is coming out.
Love it.
And hopefully that'll be early fall or sometime
Fantastic.
Around the fall. And that's going to be five. I hadn't decided. I'm thinking about putting six songs on it. I'm big with 3, 6, and 9. I like that.
That's a good. There's nothing like a nice 9-song record. You know what I mean?
There's never been a 9-song. That's true.
Nice, you know?
So I'm thinking I might put six songs on it.
Yeah, I love it.
And do that. But that'll be coming out next. We'll hopefully be going into the studio soon. But the goal is to hopefully be touring at some point.
Fantastic.
And I want to go through Texas. I want to go and tour and do shows outside of Nashville.
Okay.
And I don't ever rarely get a chance to do that. So
yeah,
that's something I hope to do soon.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it.
Come back and do it again sometime.
I would love to.
Yeah, we'll talk more aliens and psychedelics.
Yeah, man.
we'll go real deep in
this. This is awesome. Thank you, man. That was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank y'all for having me.
Enjoy it.
Yeah.
That was a ball.
I hope
that
I don't ever sound like an idiot or anything.
I do all the time.